It's the center of our solar system, and there'd be no life on our planet without it. Yes, this week's Please Explain is all about the sun. And joining me now to talk about Old Sol are Dr. Grace Wolfe Chase, an astronomer with Chicago's Adler Planetarium and a senior research associate in the Department of Astrophysics at the University of Chicago, and Chris Lintott, an astrophysicist with Oxford University and the co-host of the BBC's astronomy program, The Sky at Night. Welcome to our show.
Good evening.
Hi, Leonard, and hi, Chris.
And as always, we invite your calls and questions on the sun at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Let's begin with you, Grace. What is our sun primarily made of?
Well, our sun is a big, bright, hot gas of mostly hydrogen gas, gas in the form of plasma, which is where the atoms are so hot that the electrons and the atomic nuclei are independent of each other, can move independently of each other, so the atoms are ionized.
And there's also helium?
There's also helium, yes, approximately a little bit less than 75% by mass hydrogen, about 25% or so helium, and then all the heavier elements, which astronomers like to refer to as the metals.
How are all those atoms interacting with each other?
Well, that's a very good question. They're moving in. The sun is extremely dense at the core and gets less dense as you go further out. A lot of pressure, very, very high temperature. So the sun, most of the sun is kind of like a soup of particles, of ionized particles. So you get electrons and atoms and light that's created through fusion reactions at the core of the sun, kind of bouncing around together. And among other things, besides gravity being a very, very important force holding the sun together, magnetic fields are very important, because where you have moving charged particles, you generate magnetic fields, which in turn the particles follow. So the motions get very complicated and very very twisted, and result in some pretty spectacular events on the sun.
But you said nuclear fusion rather than nuclear fission.
That's correct. Nuclear fusion. At the core of the sun, and other stars as well, by the way, the temperature and pressures are so high, so you can fuse hydrogen atoms together to form the heavier element helium and get out energy among some other particles in the process. So yes, that's right. That's the way energy is produced at the core of the sun.
And scientists have tried to create a sustaining nuclear fusion reaction on Earth and haven't done very well. Is it because we just can't get that much pressure going?
Well, pressure and temperature certainly is a big consideration. Yeah, I'm not a particle physicist. I have to preface this with, I'm an observational star forming person. So I study, most of my interests lie in how stars and planetary systems form to begin with. Stars like our sun and stars unlike our sun.
Let's get Chris in here. How does our sun's size compare to other stars in our galaxy?
It's slightly disappointing. It's one of the long series of blows to our pride that the history of astronomy consists of. You know, we're not the center of the solar system here on Earth. The sun isn't anything particularly special in the galaxy. It's what we'd class as a dwarf star, so it's smaller than average. And you know, if we weren't orbiting it, we'd think it was nothing special. It's a perfectly normal star. Others are much more luminous. If you go out and look at the constellation of Cygnus, the star Deneb there gives out 70,000 times as much light as our sun does. It's not the smallest by any long shot. You get all sorts of very small brown dwarfs, so-called almost planet-sized stars that we're learning about in the last 10 years. And the sun sits somewhere in the middle. And in some sense, that's, you know, it's a good thing for us. It's an ordinary star. It's relatively stable. It's not. Some stars vary wildly on short time scales. The sun doesn't do that. It's in nice, comfortable middle age. It's been around for more than 4 billion years, and we've got at least another 4 billion before anything dramatic happens to it. So So it's not a bad place to be, all in all.
Is Cygnus brighter because it has different elements making up its component elements?
Not quite. It's the star Deneb in Cygnus. And what's happening is this is one of the really big stars in the universe. And big, massive stars are like the rock stars of the galaxy. They live fast and they die young. What's happening is that the really big stars have even higher temperatures and pressures at their core. So the nuclear fusion reactions get driven faster and faster. And so even though there's much more fuel in something like Deneb than there is in our sun, it will get used up in maybe 30 million years, something like that, which is, to an astronomer, that's no time at all, like clicking your fingers.
But would Deneb also be mostly hydrogen and then some helium and then other elements?
Almost all the stars are primarily hydrogen. In fact, all the stars are primarily hydrogen. But the interesting thing is that little sprinkle of heavy elements that Grace talked about at the beginning there, because those elements tell us that the sun is not a first-generation star. When the universe began 13.7 billion years ago, what formed in the Big Bang was basically hydrogen and a little helium. Everything else is produced in the cores of stars. So by looking at those elements in the sun, we know that the material that makes up the solar system has been through at least one star in the past and probably a couple of stars before forming our sun. So it's a stunning thought that anything in the solar system that isn't hydrogen and helium, everything you can see when you look around you, has gone through at least one generation of star before ending up here.
My guests are Chris Lintott, an astrophysicist with Oxford University, co-host of the BBC's astronomy program, The Sky at Night, and Dr. Grace Wolfe Chase, an astronomer with Chicago's Adler Planetarium and a senior research associate in the Department of Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're doing Please Explain on today's show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and in a little while we'll take your calls at 212-433-9692. Grace, what are sunspots?
Very good question. Sunspots are actually regions of intense magnetic activity on the sun. Now, they appear dark, but that's a little bit deceptive because if you could actually remove them from the bright surface of the sun, they would indeed glow kind of a deep orange-red. So they are dark with respect to the rest of the surface of the sun, which is a bit hotter. So the magnetic fields actually are the reason why the temperatures are a little bit cooler in the regions of sunspots. So they're kind of places on the sun where the sun's magnetic field has gotten kind of tangled up and popped out of the surface of the sun. So what's happening here is the sun is this huge ball of plasma, and it doesn't rotate like a baton or something, like a solid object. It rotates actually a bit faster at the equator than it does at the poles. And so what happens with all of these charged particles bouncing around creating magnetic fields, the magnetic fields get twisted over the course of time and pop out as are seen as sunspots. So those are regions that are seen to be associated with strong magnetic activity on the sun.
Don't sunspots happen in decade-long cycles?
Yes, they do. In fact, it's called the Maunder cycle, and over the course of about 11 years, and I believe the last sunspot maximum was around the year 2001, a few sunspots will appear at around mid-latitudes, halfway, not quite halfway between the equator and the pole of the sun, and they generally increase in number over time and migrate closer to the equator towards the sunspot maximum, and then after 11 years, things get so twisted up that the polarity reverses and the north and south pole of the sun get flipped and the cycle kind of repeats. So it's in 11-year cycles from sunspot minimum to maximum, but then 22 years for the entire cycle.
And one of the interesting things here is that, as Grace said, the maximum was 2001, somewhere around then. So we've just gone through minimum. And in fact, we saw the first sunspots of the new cycle last year. But the sun's been unusually quiet for the last 12 months or so. So we're really waiting. If you want an update on what weather on the sun is like at the minute, we're waiting for the new cycle to get going. It's a complicated process, as we're probably demonstrating by trying to explain it. The details aren't obvious, and it's not as regular as clockwork. So we're waiting for the sun to become more active, and there's beginning to be some worry, I think, among the solar scientists as to whether we understand what's going on.
Well, that's maybe right. with a new president in the White House, things will clear up. Why does it affect radio transmission and television transmission?
Well, this is more to do with the sun. Well, the sun is the dominant body in the solar system, and we know that because of its gravity and we orbit it. But it also has other effects, and in particular, when the sun is active, material gets caught up in these twisted magnetic fields that Grace was talking about. And in fact, they can become so twisted that material gets fired off the sun in what we call a coronal mass ejection. But think of it as just gas being thrown off from the sun and out into the solar system.
What we call solar flares?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
A coronal mass ejection is a really big solar flare, at least as far as I understand it.
As far as the mass goes, that's true. Flares, I believe, are the most energetic thing in the solar system, but the coronal mass ejections can involve an awful lot of mass, 20 billion tons of matter. And just to use an analogy of just how much mass that is, picture a cube of lead about 3/4 of a mile on a side. That would have approximately the same weight.
Are solar flares different from solar wind?
The solar wind is what you get every day. There's always a stream of particles being thrown off the sun. The solar flares are a dramatic example of that. Think of the gusts rather than the regular wind. The point is that these particles can hit the Earth and interact with our atmosphere. And the magnetic field of the Earth protects us from the worst of the effects. You'd have a lot harder time. For example, astronauts up in space have to worry about their exposure to this radiation, for that's what it is. But the interaction with the atmosphere can interfere with radio communications. It can knock out power on satellites. And there have even been reports from particularly energetic events that have caused power blackouts because you can induce a surge in the power lines, particularly in northern latitudes. So I think you're south enough to be safe. But Canada certainly has this problem and various parts of the world at northerly latitudes.
Grace, can you tell us about the IBEX project?
Oh, I would love to, yes. It's a small NASA mission. IBEX stands for Interstellar Boundary Explorer. And we at ADLER are doing education and public outreach for this NASA mission that is led by Dave McComas at the Southwest Research Institute. Among other educational products, we are currently creating a sky show for planetarium theaters called IBEX Search for the Edge of the Solar System. And that is indeed what IBEX is going to do, only it's going to search for the edge of the solar system from a very highly elliptic orbit around the Earth. And what it's going to be, how it's going to be searching for the edge of the solar system. The solar wind, as Chris and I have been talking about, it constantly streams off of the sun. And it streams off at the sun at very, very large velocities, supersonic speeds. But it gets to a point where the solar wind flow drops below the sound speed. And that's a region where that sort of transitions from what we would locate as the edge of our solar system and interstellar space. So where the solar wind drops below the sound speed is where it starts to interact with what we call the interstellar medium, the atoms and ions and gas particles between the stars.
Okay.
I was going to say one way of visualizing this, a little visualization that we give people, is to take a flat plate, run it under a stream of water, and you'll see that the water will stream sort of radially away from the center point, and then it will reach a region where it sort of becomes turbulent. Well, that sort of turbulent region is where the solar wind is interacting with particles from the interstellar medium. One of the products produced out there is something called energetic neutral atoms that are created at this boundary and travel in all different directions, some of them back to Earth. And IBEX is actually going to be not studying any kind of light, but it's going to be collecting energetic neutral atoms. And in the process, it's going to actually map out what some of those processes look like around our solar system that create what we call the heliosphere, which is a little bit of a misnomer because it's not really sphere-shaped. It's probably more teardrop-shaped. But what IBEX will do is it will orbit the Earth, getting very close to the Earth, but also getting about 5/6 of the way to the Moon, where we get outside of the Earth's magnetic influence. And we can study some of these interactions unimpeded.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back to that and take calls at 212-433-9692. My guests are Dr. Grace Wolf-Chase of Chicago's Adler Planetarium, a senior research associate in the Department of Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. Also, Chris Lintott of Oxford University and co-host of the BBC's astronomy program, The Sky at Night. Stay with us for more, Please Explain. We're back with our two guests on Please Explain today, Chris Lintott and Dr. Grace Wolf-Chase, talking about the sun and its importance to our world. The solar winds cause those auroras that we see in the more northern parts of our planet?
They certainly do. That's what happens when material from the sun, from the solar wind, hits our atmosphere and excites atoms. Can create these beautiful changing displays of to the northern lights for us here in the northern hemisphere. And they're almost always there. That's the interesting thing. If you look down from space, you can quite often, if you look at the right frequency, you see this ring of aurora around the Earth's pole. What you have to do to see a really good display is be in the right place at the right time. So I've spent some time flying up to northern Norway to get some dark skies and sit and wait, and just occasionally you're lucky and you see this beautiful effect caused by the sun. It's a real reminder that we're subject to whatever it chooses to throw at us.
You can also see it in northern Scotland, can't you?
You can. They'll kill me for saying so, but it's harder to get clear skies in northern Scotland.
So. Our number here is 212-433-9692. Let's take some calls. And we begin with Phil from Queens. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Very interesting show. I didn't hear the beginning. Did you ask the guests whether or not changes in the sun in the past 10 or 20 years have helped to cause global warming? And I just want to put in a plug. I hope the Chicago Planetarium gets its new projector. It's a wonderful institution. I've been there several times.
Became a big issue in the last presidential, I guess it was the last presidential debate. But that's a whole other matter. Is there a link between global warming and what's happening with the sun?
The straight answer is no. There's absolutely no evidence over the last century of any changes in the sun's behavior. We see these small-scale fluctuations, this 11-year cycle we talked about earlier, and cycles differ from one another, but there's no systematic trend over the last century that can account for what we've seen here on Earth. So astronomers aren't guilty for this one. It's not our fault, and it's not the sun's fault either.
James from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to pose a question. Will our sun start to shrink in size within, say, 25 or 50 years? And secondly, is there another sun that is close to our galaxy?
Well, the sun is sort of self-regulating. The sun is in sort of an intricate balance between gravity and pressure created by the fusion reactions at the core. And indeed, that's why it doesn't explode. If you have a lot of pressure under, that's contained, you get an explosion. But the sun, if there's more pressure being created at the core, it just expands a little bit. So all of these are normal, regular effects that the sun has been doing stably over the past 4.6 billion years of its lifetime. And I didn't quite catch the second part of your question there.
He wanted to know if there were other stars that were similar to our sun close by our galaxy.
close by within our
within
galaxy.
Within our galaxy.
Yes. So our galaxy is this large spiral-shaped system of over 200 billion stars. And yes, there are indeed quite a few stars like the Sun, and a number of stars also that are much more massive than the Sun, as Chris was talking about earlier. They're rarer. The most common stars are the smaller, little, hotter red stars that have very long lifetimes compared to the Sun, because they're not the energy guzzlers. They're kind of the, you know, economic vehicles in our galaxy. One of the very interesting questions, of course, is how many stars similar to our Sun have planetary systems, and we're learning a lot about that. We've been learning a lot about that over the past 15 years or so.
Is that where we look for planets, to stars that are similar to ours?
Those are one of the places we look. We look for stars similar to ours, some that are a little bit cooler than our Sun, a little bit warmer, but we do look at stars primarily that have lifetimes long enough where we think that there's, you know, a chance for life perhaps to have evolved on a planet similar to Earth. You know, and of course all of this is prefaced with similar to Earth. The kinds of searches that are going on for planets kind of presuppose we're looking for life that would be similar to life on Earth, because we don't really have meaningful ways of talking about life that's not similar to life on Earth.
Now, Chris, you said earlier that our Sun is 4 billion years old and probably will live another 4 billion years. What will happen after that?
Well, it's a dramatic end. So at some point, the Sun's going to run out of fuel at its core. So at some point, it will run out of hydrogen. And if you do the maths on this, and we can go through that if you want, but you don't want to, then trust me that what happens is something quite counterintuitive. What actually happens is that the Sun swells up to be much, much larger than its current size. It becomes what we call a red giant star. And the outer edge of the Sun, depends who you believe, will be roughly where you're sitting in. I'm sitting now. The Earth will probably be inside this giant red giant Sun. What's happening at the core at that stage is that it's not hydrogen being fused to form helium, but helium being fused to form heavier elements. Eventually, though, you run out of helium. The Sun gently puffs off its outer layers in a really beautiful phase we call a planetary nebula. You see these very intricate shapes of dying stars, and then we're left with the core of the Sun will be what we call a white dwarf. Think of it as the ember of the star.
And will a black hole eventually result out of that?
No, black holes come from stars much bigger than the Sun. They have a much more dramatic end because they produce heavier and heavier elements at their center until they produce iron. And iron is the most stable of all the atoms. And once you produce iron, you end up consuming energy at the core instead of producing it. And they explode. And that can lead to your black hole. But the Sun's, think of it as, you know, it's a quiet, it likes an easy life. It's going to fade away slowly in this long existence as a white dwarf. And white dwarfs just cool gently until they're the background temperature of the universe. But that will take many billions of billions of billions of years.
We're about to experience another kind of black hole because, Chris, you told us you would have to leave at 1:50 our time.
I'm afraid
and that's now.
But, okay, thank you very much.
But Grace is staying with us. Chris Lintott is an astrophysicist with Oxford University and co-host of the BBC's astronomy program, The Sky at Night. Thank you so much for being on Please Explain with us today.
It's been a pleasure. See you again.
And Grace, you're ready to take some more calls?
I sure am.
Okay, let's go to Bill from Brooklyn. Hi. Bill, are you listening? Okay, we're on delay, and Bill is not paying attention. We're going to move on to Lilibet from Gladstone, New Jersey. Hi, Lilibet.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay.
This might be crazy, but I'm concerned about, with the energy that's out there in the atmosphere, the usage or the multi-usage of the cell phones and other items that we're using, because that's energy. Is that having an effect on the Sun and on the atmosphere?
To the best of my knowledge, as far as our atmosphere goes, no. On the Sun, No. There's very little that we could do on Earth that would have an effect on the sun.
Cumulatively, it doesn't have one. Okay.
No.
It's energy. That's why it's an energy field.
No worries. Yeah. Well, life is all about energy, right?
Right.
That's what life does. It uses energy. And, you know, energy is what it's all about. And the sun is a beautiful, big source of energy that's going to be there for billions of years.
Thank you so much for your call. Michael from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. Thank you. A couple months ago, I saw Al Gore on a talk show. I don't remember what it was, but he said something very stunning and amazing, that in the middle of any typical day, like 40 minutes in the middle of a day, we receive enough energy from the sun to power our entire country for a whole year. And is this
yes, and in fact, you know, closer to the sun produces enough energy to sustain us for the lifetime of the Earth. So yes, that is true. It's just the question of how to harness it, how
right.
to use it, and that, of course, you know, entails more technological difficulties.
Thank you so much for your call. We are talking about trying to switch over to solar power, but right now the problem has less to do with the sun and more to do with our ability to create things that catch the sun's rays efficiently.
Right, absolutely. You might be familiar with many years ago, the physicist and very creative thinker Freeman Dyson posited that a really advanced civilization might break down planets in its system and form a large spherical surface around its star to capture sort of all that free energy. And Dyson spheres haven't been observed yet, but it was certainly a great idea, and science fiction often does come up with great ideas that inform technologies of the future.
Let's go to another call. Stanley from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
My question is whether the loss of mass at the edge of the solar system is counterbalanced by the gain of mass from outer space, or whether the mass of the solar system increases or decreases as a result of such process.
Well,
does this really have to do with the sun?
Well, yes, it's the solar system.
Okay.
Well, you can think of it like this. Before I was asked a question about this interstellar boundary explorer mission, and the relevance, the importance of the solar wind and the interaction of the solar wind with the material around us is that we sort of, our sun shields us. We kind of live in a protective bubble due to the sun's magnetic magnetosphere, due to the sun's magnetic field and the solar wind. And that bubble is kind of, this isn't strictly true, but you could think of it kind of as a pressure balance. The sun also orbits through the galaxy, orbits around the center of the galaxy. So sometimes we're in parts of the galaxy where there are like thicker gas and dust clouds, and at other points in time, we're in more rarefied parts of the galaxy. Right now, we're kind of in a very rarefied part of the galaxy. So the bubble around the sun can be influenced by what the medium it's traveling through. So I wouldn't say that there are things like mass coming into the solar system and exiting the solar system, but when that bubble, at times in the past of the in the history of our solar system, if we were traveling through a very, very dense cloud, that protective bubble could be made so small, could be compressed so small, it might be interior to the orbit of the Earth, in which case there are indeed very high energetic charged particles called cosmic rays. More of those could get through and potentially affect life on Earth. And in fact, it's even been speculated that such large influxes of cosmic rays might influence mutations on Earth and evolution. So in that sense, things coming in could affect the Earth. But our sun does offer us a big layer of protection.
We have very little time, but I'm glad you brought up evolution. What do you say to people who claim that the universe is only 5,000 or so years old?
Well, of course, it's very difficult to talk about how you build up a picture. The way science works, of course, is we start out by making hypotheses, testing them, and then eventually turning those into theories. And one thing about a scientific theory is it has to make predictions, and it also has to fit in with what we know from other fields. So the theory of evolution isn't really just, an aspect of biology, a very important aspect of biology, but it's important to the universe in general, because in astronomy and with our recent technologies, we can explore the universe out to distances that bring us information from light that left their sources so many billions of years ago that we're seeing the universe when it was younger than it is now.
So are we seeing stars form on the edge of the universe?
We can study star formation within our galaxy in fairly good detail, but yes, we can study stages that galaxies went through billions of years ago by capturing light from these galaxies that lie at 10 billion or so light years away. So what a light year is it's distance, first of all.
Yeah, we've run out of time, unfortunately. But you can look up light years. Just go to Google, look up light years. Dr. Grace Wolf Chase is an astronomer with Chicago's Adler Planetarium and a senior research associate in the Department of Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. Thank you so much for being with us on today's Please Explain.
Thank you, Leonard.